Again, if you've got control over your resource allocation, then providing quality of service is just a matter of matching the amount of resources you give to a user to what they need. Okay. If you don't have control over your allocations, then somehow you have to, within a contention-based but distributed system, find a way of distinguishing between applications and essentially favoring applications that have greater requirements. Okay, so don't know why this is in again, but so again, Wi-Fi, all of the more modern versions of Wi-Fi do use modulation encoding schemes, which again is going to determine what bit rate you can get through a channel. But again, essentially, it's not much you can do about it because you know, you are only going to have a channel available to you. Okay, and we already looked at, you know, again, there's a load of different possibilities for our schemes. Okay, so we already looked at that in a previous lecture. So now the question is, can we somehow achieve different resource allocations for different types of traffic? Okay. And so we can note that there is defined a point control function which offers contention-free access to the network, so by having the access point control the access. Okay. And so for that, we do the usual. We define traffic classes and traffic streams within the class, so instances of a given class, and give service based on each stream, so give the stream the necessary resources. Okay, so if you've implemented PCF, you're doing essentially the same thing that you do for WiMAX or LTE, but PCF is almost never implemented, so you don't have that option.
Okay. Even though it's distributed, it's still only with an access point that isn't implemented, is it?
Well, essentially this isn't implemented. It's in the standards. And it would only work if you had an access point, because you do need, again, some centralized control. It's essentially providing a centralized controller, like we do for WiMAX or LTE. It doesn't tend to be implemented, so this is a theoretical solution, not a pragmatic one. Okay, so the only other option is to work on top of our contention-based system. Okay, and the 802.11e standard suggests how this can be done. So it's EDCA, Enhanced Distributed Channel Access. And so we define traffic classes and priorities, and then we try to favor certain classes over others in terms of medium access. So, how do we do this? Well, we've already actually discussed a method by which you could favor classes one over the other. You know, primarily we have to use our interframe spacings. Okay. So if you're following the longer your interframe spacing, the lower priority you are, because you're waiting longer than higher priority channel or user or lower IFS streams, and therefore are less likely to get in. Okay, so for EDCA, you define four traffic classes. You have a voice, you have a video, and you have best efforts. Within those, again, you use your interframe spacing to favor your higher priority classes. So essentially you want to favor voice and video over your best effort. Okay, so best effort will have longer interframe spacing. Okay. So essentially what that does is, again, it's you're going to allow voice and video packets to get through before best effort packets. Okay. Okay. So it's a little more complicated than that. So as I mentioned, you use your interframe spacing to prioritize types of traffic. So the shorter your interframe spacing, the higher priority and the better access it gets. There actually is one other parameter we can play with, and that's the contention window. So that defines your backoff. So if you have a collision, the bigger your contention window, the larger periods your backoff will fall in, and therefore, on average, the longer amount of time you'll back off for. So, if you have something that you're really concerned about getting through, you keep your contention window small, so more important traffic will back off less on average than less important traffic. And finally, so somebody sees the medium. So somebody's gotten through. We want them to have a greater opportunity to transmit data. So instead of sending a single packet or frame, they're allowed a transmission opportunity. So once a data stream has seized the medium, they're given a certain amount of time in which they send whatever they can, as much as they can. And so within those three parameters, we first establish a priority, and then we essentially establish an allocation policy, so certain applications will get more time to transmit than others, again, hopefully based on what they need. Okay, so within that, we're allowed, we can cater for different sorts of traffic. And so we've defined essentially two classes of background traffic, best effort traffic. And the only distinction between the two best effort classes is the priority. So best effort here is given a higher priority than our genuine background class. So some things we'd like to get through, and some things, well, we never even get to it. Both these best effort and background classes, they're allowed to contend to send single packets, so there's no transmission opportunity. They just get to send their single shot packet, and that's that. Okay. Then we have voice and video. And so, you'll see they both have the same interframe spacing, so in that sense they're considered to be the same priority, but the intention window for voice is kept smaller than video, anyway, because you can tolerate that's to keep the delay down and the play out right fast. And then we also see that there's a difference in transmission opportunities. And so once either a voice stream or a video stream sees the medium, video gets twice the, gets sent twice the amount of data. Okay. So, again, we see that using this combination, you can get sort of a priority of access and then a resource allocation within that access.
Should there be, or is there a ratio between the size of the contention window and the number of nodes on your network? It's not necessarily one-to-one or anything like that.
Well, the size of the contention, if you remember back, the size of the contention window was defined by how many times you had a collision. Okay? And again, if you're not doing any of this, you go to a quite a large contention window. Okay? And as I said, what happens with the contention window is it just spreads out your time of back off. Yeah, it does it randomly, so you could still have a huge contention window and get in or start seek access fairly quickly. But on average, the bigger your contention window is, the longer you're going to wait before you even seek access again. Okay. And so what this says is that essentially it's pretty important that voice gets regular access. You're sending smaller amounts, but you have to send them fairly frequently. Video, you can get a little less access, or a little less frequent access, but then balanced out by being able to send more when you do get that access. Okay. So what this says is, well, you always have to have some backoff. Variability. So here you'd be between 0 and 7, here you'd be between 0 and 16. So there we are, between immediately or not. But then again, as you have collisions, that window will increase in size. So the number of users, is that was your question? The number of users?
Yeah.
Well, see, the number of, you don't know how many users are in the system. So you can't explicitly say, well, the more users, probably what you need is the more users, the bigger contention window. But essentially that's going to be inferred. If there are too many users, you're going to keep getting collisions and your contention window size is going to increase. And so the next question is, well, what if you have too many users and you're still doing this? And the answer is actually that with not a huge number of users, you'll just, the network keels over. So this works up to an extent, but it's still relying on not having a complete overload. So yeah, if you have lots of users, lots of people trying to do video, you know, sort of a voice stream at the same time, the network's just going to keel over. So, because it's contention-based, there's only so far you can go with this. It will work if you're not too heavily loaded.
Okay, which probably is our wrap-up point for EDCA, so we can define our traffic classes. The traffic classes receive favorable treatment. This offers no guarantees for any stream, data stream within that traffic class. Okay, so
there is still contention amongst the classes, although again with the interframe spacing and the contention window, it's much more likely that a higher priority class will get the access. But then within that class, any given stream is going to contend with any other stream for the same access. Okay.
So it's still a contention-based system. Okay, so I have a few references here if you want to look into any more detail at any of that, any of those policies. So that's a sort of high-level view of how quality of service is catered for in various wireless networks. Again, with the idea that the main issue with quality of service is this access link, so our link from the user into the network, our radio link from the user into the network. And as we saw, it's at least theoretically a lot easier if you have control over your complete control over the allocation of the resources, then it just becomes a matter of deciding what your allocation policies are, which can get as complicated as you want. Okay, if you don't have that control, then there's only sort of a limited, have a limited toolkit that you can use. So our final topic, then, is going to be just a quick look at multi-hop wireless networks. And this is a bit of a grab bag. Mobile ad hoc networking, it's a bit of a grab bag, which underlying with there's a lot of use cases, so different applications that all fall under this general heading of, again, a wireless multi-hop network. Because there are so many use cases, the architecture, everything about them tends to be sort of tied to exactly what you're trying to do.
The key point that I'm going to emphasize again is the idea of routing for these sorts of networks. Okay, so again, what changes because we now have multi-hop, multiple wireless links, and again, the fact that, and the main thing is that our, at least at the extreme end, our topology is fairly pathological. Everything can be moving essentially all the time. We'll just mention a few of the sort of common classes of routing policies. And again, exactly which one sort of works the best tends to then depend on exactly on what your use case is and how pathological is your topology, how much power do you have to spend on processing, etc. Okay. So everything we've looked at so far is looking at a single radio link. So getting from the user essentially to an access point. We're now going to look at multi-hop networks really quickly, as you can tell, since we're going to finish it off today. And again, it's a grab bag of applications and uses. Some of the more common forms are wireless mesh networks, and here typically you have set up some sort of infrastructure, so sort of like you have a network of access points. The difference now is that the network is communicating wirelessly instead of in a wired fashion. So that's fairly well behaved. There'll be performance issues having to do with the wireless links, but it's reasonably well behaved. Hey, you have mobile ad hoc networks. So now we don't have any fixed topology, but you have devices with reasonable processing capabilities attempting to form a network. Again, there's a lot of specific use cases over which you might want to do that. We'll have a look in a second. And then sort of down at the bottom end, we have wireless sensor networks. So here we have a lot of devices with very limited processing and power, but still trying to transmit data again, over multiple hops, typically so that it can be collected at various points. Okay. So wireless mesh networks, we have, again, a relatively fixed infrastructure. So a lot of times we'll have somebody, we're essentially setting up almost a cellular network, allowing sort of access from either users or other networks, and possibly providing sort of for an end user providing access over a greater area, possibly on a temporary basis. So an example might be if you had some event, a sports event or a concert, you might set up sort of additional routers to take pressure off, say, your cellular network, which, because you're at aggregate more people than usual into a specific spot. Okay, so these may again, these routers may act as access points, but then route the data to get it either to the internet or other network resources. Okay. Well, typically, we assume that our mesh routers have power sources, they're stationary, they have good computational power. So in terms of, certainly in terms of routing, they're not actually that problematic. You can understand the topology is not changing. You have sufficient power to make your routing decisions. And so the main issues tend to be with link quality and possibly having your routing policies in some way account for link quality as well as just sort of hop. Okay, so these are relatively
well behaved. Sensor networks
tend to consist of two components of the sensors, and so these would be sort of very simple devices. We assume they're battery powered. Possibly they're mobile. I think in this scenario you're trying to monitor, for instance, a herd of deer, so you tack a sensor onto each deer, and then they're broadcasting certain data that you want to know, maybe the location, the health of the animal, whatever. Okay. Possibly there's some simple forwarding of data going on from sensor to sensor, but your goal is to get as quickly as possible to a data aggregator, which collects the sensor data. If you're lucky, it's powered, or at least it's got a bigger battery for greater duration. We'll have less mobility. A lot of times the aggregators will be placed in fixed location. Okay, and then those aggregators will try and route the data back to some sort of remote monitoring center. Okay. So what were the bad bits about this from a routing perspective? Well, the mobile sensor part is really pathological, so you have things that are moving all the time, which makes it difficult to route. And you also have limited computational power or computational ability, and you don't want to use a lot of computational resources, because there are also power resources. You're on a battery. So routing amongst the sensors tends to be problematic, and to be avoided sort of as much as possible, so you want to get to the aggregator as quickly as possible. Sort of in between those two cases, you have the idea of ad hoc networking. So you have peer devices with greater power and computational ability. But again, possibly moving and not necessarily behaving themselves well in terms of providing a fixed network topology. Okay, so uses, again, the first one thought of was something like collaborative computing. So, again, we all have our laptops, and instead of going to a Wi-Fi network, why can't we just sort of connect to each other? Disaster recovery, so if your infrastructure has been destroyed, then can you set up networks to sort of get some sort of communication going? And of course, the military application of battlefield communications. Okay. So here we assume that our nodes have computational ability. Okay, we also assume that we want to conserve our battery as much as possible, so to have to use that computational ability as lightly as possible. The nodes will cooperate to share information over our wireless links, and the network can vary in size and mobility. Okay. So again, in terms of routing, we do have the possibility of having reasonably complex routing procedures, but they have to be aware of the fact that, again, the network topology is changing all the time.
Okay. So, again, we'll just give a few examples of this. Before doing that, again, we'll have a look at routing in the wired context. Okay, so again, whatever networks course you have, we'll probably discuss various ways of calculating routes. Typically, if you have a network, you're trying to find the least cost from point A to B, where that cost can either be the number of hops you're going through or some other metric. Okay. So again, just everything goes wrong with these sorts of networks. The channels are not reliable, possibly, because they're wireless. One result for wireless is the more hops you take, again, the more loss you experience. Mobility is meaning that you have no fixed network architecture or topology, and you have a lack of centralized control, so you can't, generally assume there's no controller that's able to tell people what to do. And so they have to make their own decisions and at the same time, again, conserve computational and battery resources. So, again, there's loads of issues going on with these sorts of networks. Medium access control becomes more complicated. Okay, we're assuming we don't have our centralized control, so you have to have a contention-based system. And again, with a unknown topology, you're running into your hidden and exposed node problems. Routing is difficult because of the topology changes and possibly your limited computational ability. Quality of service, again, you can't, you're with mobility, you have all the issues of the changing quality of the link. If you have battery power, power savings becomes an issue. Security is obviously an issue because it's the whole network is radio driven now. Okay, so again, we're just going to look at that one issue of routing. Okay, and the point we'll start at is the with wireless routing. And so, again, our goal is to find the least cost path between a sender and receiver. And so cost, well, that is sort of simple as something like hop count. But you can also add additional factors, a financial cost. You might factor in delay, so if there's congestion, you might make that link, if a link is congested, you make that link more expensive so that the traffic is moving away from it. Okay. Now maybe the link is slower than other options. Okay. But however you define your cost, you try and minimize that when you're looking for your route. And so our goal is to have, well, a correct policy that's relatively simple and efficient, that's robust to change, although, again, the assumption is that in our wired network, things aren't changing rapidly. Okay, so we do, if a node goes down, that's fine, you need to route around it, but that doesn't happen that often. And then issues of stability, fairness, optimality. Okay. When we're talking optimality, you have to say what you're optimizing against. Okay. So is it network metrics like throughput or individual user metrics like delay? Okay. But anyway, there's some fairly standard ways of determining routing policies for wired networks. Okay, and typically routers run decentralized routing algorithms. And then, since it is decentralized, they have to have some sort of mechanism of communicating amongst themselves, so sharing information amongst themselves. Again, if you had a global controller, that controller could hold all the information, make all the decisions, and just tell the routers about them. But now, the routers need to get sufficient information from their peers to be able to make the appropriate decision. Okay. So they do this in a centralized fashion by communicating with each other, and again, it has the algorithm has to be running constantly in order to account for changes. So there are two basic algorithms, link state routing and distance vector routing. And the only sort of takeaway point, I'll give a few details, but the only real takeaway point for us is that the way these algorithms are distinguished is in how much information is shared and to whom. And so you can either share a lot of information with your neighbors, which then propagates out eventually, or you can share a little information with everybody, which propagates more quickly. Okay. So just sort of a basic setup. Any router can reach its immediate neighbors by a single network link. And we say that there's a cost to transmitting the link, not to receiving. Routers, then their goal is to decide on the least cost path
the destination. And based on that, they will forward the packet by one hop. Okay. So A, if it wants to send send a packet to C, will calculate what's the shortest route to do that. But based on that, all it does is it forwards, say, is it obvious? One, two, okay, so it's the shortest route, so it's going to be B. So it knows the full route, but all it does is it forwards the packet to B.
So one hop decision. Okay. So if the node has the full picture of the network, then it can determine this least cost. We're not going to go into the algorithms by which it does that, but it's able to do it.
Okay. Therefore, again, what's important is how a node gets a picture of a network. Okay. So, again, here, A is trying to make these decisions, and it's determined, it's sort of processed the picture of the network. Okay, so again, distance vector routing and link state routing are going to provide two different ways of exchanging that information. Okay, so distance vector routing was the original approach the internet took to determining routes. And here, all nodes periodically send all of their information to their immediate neighbors. Okay. So you're sending a large amount of information, but only a small distance.
And you can probably imagine that there are the optimizations to that. The information hasn't really changed. You don't really need to send it again. So, but potentially you're sending lots of information to neighbors. Okay. So how do non-neighbors acquire that information? Well, they have to, essentially, you have a ripple effect. If A sends information to B, then in the next cycle, B will send that information on to C. Okay. So, if between any two nodes there's a path of a certain length, say three hops, then within three cycles, the information from A will have traveled those three hops and gotten to all points in the node, in the network. So, again, one of the, so the, this dissemination of information can be slightly problematic. In that it's taking some number of cycles. The number of cycles it takes depends on how many hops you're having to take. And you could ask the question, how does that work if your network topology is changing? So I send this information, it's cycling through, but possibly by the next time I'm ready to transmit information, everything's changed. Okay, so there is an issue with because it's taking a while for the information to propagate through the network, there is an issue that if it's changing too fast, you know, you're in trouble. Okay. So this was the original protocol used in the internet. There are a few issues with it. It's possible for loops to develop, so you might start cycling your packets around in a loop, which, again, that's problematic. And there are ways of dealing with that, but it's sort of an addition to the regular protocol. You have a slow convergence because, you know, again, of the slow propagation of information through the network. Attempts to solve these problems led to the proposal of link state routing. And again, this was link state routing is a different way of sharing information amongst the, through the network. Okay. So with link state routing, each node sends not its full view of the network, but just its view of its neighbors, and it sends that throughout the through the whole network now. Okay. This isn't done on a periodic basis, but it's done as a response to changes in the network. Okay, so in this way, all of the nodes fairly rapidly get a view of the entire network, and therefore you can sort of react. You can react changes faster. The algorithms now needed to calculate the cost, the least cost paths, are more complicated than they were for distance vector routing. Again, we're not dealing with the algorithms, so we won't worry about why, but they just are. Okay. So again, if things are changing rapidly, then you can generate significant traffic, but you're sort of updating the state of the network, and again, the work to react to changing traffic is more significant. Okay, well, this is used in the internet. I think I have another slide on this next, but again, the calculations, again, are the complexity is based on the size of the network, so the internet will, in addition, it won't view everything as being a flat topology, but you will essentially divide the network into regions with gateways, and then you have routing within the region, and then routing within your from gateway to gateway. Okay, so that's sort of limits the size of the network on which you're trying to find these shortest paths. Okay, and yes, I did. Next slide. So we have a hierarchical routing system. Okay. So you have regions, and you essentially
move, if you have to move between regions, then you have gateways that connect your networks. So you can navigate within the region, and again, these will be a fixed, manageable size. And then between regions via the gateways, again, there's a limited number of gateways depending on how we define our regions, and so you balance between the size of the region and the number of gateways. Okay. So, what this allows, the complexity is a function of the number of nodes in the network, so if you can keep the number of nodes to a manageable level, you limit the complexity of your algorithm. Okay. So what we've seen is for both these solutions, there are still problems if your topology is changing rapidly. For the first solution, you have the issue of the changes aren't propagating fast enough. For the second, you have the problem that you're just generating too much traffic. All your updates are adding to the traffic in the network, and particularly with wireless networks, you don't want to do that. Okay. So, again, we have our issues. So how are we able to deal with this rapidly changing topology? And a lot of the assumptions that we make for a wired network aren't possible now for our wireless, our ad hoc network. So we have our changing topology, and we can't necessarily assume that we have two-way connectivity. Again, we have limitations on our nodes and the processing power, so we don't want to use computationally complex algorithms, and we also don't want to be communicating too often. Trying to provide quality service is a whole other issue. Okay. So, can distinguish the routing protocols used for ad hoc networks based on the two things that we've talked about in terms of wired networks, based on how do we update our information. And then based on topology, and by topology I mean, do we consider just a flat collection of nodes, or do we try and impose some hierarchy? So like we had for when we spoke of hierarchy earlier, do we sort of define gateways and regions and loop within the region and then to a gateway, or what? So, in terms of information update, we split things into proactive and reactive. So proactive is what we were seeing for the wired networks. We try and maintain a view of the topology of the network, and then calculate our routes based on that view. So that has all of the problems that we mentioned of maybe too much signaling going on, or if you aren't signaling often enough, then you not a correct view of what the actual is. The network's changing too fast. You're not getting a correct view of what the network is. And having to recalculate your options all the time. Okay, so another possibility is that instead of trying to maintain a completely accurate view of the network, we just worry about it when we have data to send. So in a reactive routing policy, when we need to move data to a certain node, at that point, we seek to find a good path to that node, but not beforehand. And then you can combine the two strategies some sort of hybrid fashion, typically. Again, that would be you'd have a hybrid hierarchical structure where within a small region you probably use a proactive policy, and then if you had to go farther, you'd make that a reactive policy.
So again, proactive is what we do in the wired network. We try and maintain as complete a picture of the network as possible and
calculate our routes based on that view. For reactive, when we have to send data, we use some sort of route discovery procedure. And so that saves us having to maintain maintain a view of the network in the face of changes. But now you then face the problems that it causes delay to have to find the route. And possibly the routes aren't stable. You've done a route discovery procedure, and by the time you're finished, your route's gone away anyway. Okay.
And so again, hybrid, usually based on a hierarchy, we combine proactive and reactive routing policies. Okay, so again, proactive, it's pretty much what we saw before. We have to maintain our view of the network and act on it. So,
a number of protocols are based on distance vector routing, so exchanging information from neighbor to neighbor. And again, that has the propagation problems, but it has the benefit that you're not sending the data a long way, so it's more likely to arrive intact. Okay. And so the procedure doesn't scale terribly well, but for small scale regions, again, it might be a fairly efficient way of
doing your routing. We also have link state policies, and
there's an issue of scaling. If there's rapid changes in topology, then you're flooding the network with these updates, and that's not sustainable. And also, again, as we discussed, the calculations performed by the nodes become more expensive. And so you can try and sort of minimize those effects by combining this with a hierarchical scheme.
Okay.
So with fisheye state routing, again, you're updating according to changes, but the frequency with which the updates travel depends on how far you are from the source node. So for your local neighborhood, you have frequent updates, but not all of these would propagate throughout the entire network. So again, you're trying to minimize the amount of information that you're having to send through the whole network. So if you're close, you know, there's no real hardship in sending the information fairly frequently. The farther away you get, again, just for scaling purposes, you send it less and less frequently. So what this means is that if you're close, you've got a good picture of what's going on in the network. The farther away you get, the less often your picture is going to change. Okay. And so if you assume that sort of most communication is occurring in a relatively small region, then again you can save on
your costs while still maintaining a reasonably accurate picture of the network. Okay. But the bottom line is that there's, no matter what you do, there are scalability issues, both in terms of just trying to calculate the route and in terms of how much information you're having to send to update the network. You can make trade-offs between sort of accuracy and control overhead, as we need to be. But it is problematic trying to maintain a complete picture of the network. Okay, so your other option is to give up and just try and calculate routes when they're needed.
Okay, and if you don't mind, I'll just finish off these last few slides.
Okay, so we have our reactive routing protocols, and the key issue for them is doing route discovery. So typically you have to, when you need a route, you have to send a flooding query through the network, which will be responded to. Okay. Now, typically, you're going to cache that information. So once you've done it once, you're going to maintain that awareness of the route for at least a little while. Again, depending on your estimate of how rapidly the network is changing, we'll tell you how long you should actually keep your cached information. When a packet is sent, then it actually carries with it the complete route. Okay, so a route is found. The packet carries with it the complete address, the complete path, and what that allows it to do is that the caches for intermediate nodes can be updated as the packet travels.
Okay. So, again, you have a balance between, again, the work it takes and the communication overhead it takes to find your route and how long you maintain that, how long that route is maintained for. Okay. So, there are various flavors of permutations on this, ad hoc, on-demand, distance vector routing. Instead of keeping these paths, you do keep next hop routing tables. Instead, based on route discovery, and again, you have to, those tables will expire if they're not refreshed. So, again, it's a similar sort of idea, just a slightly different implementation. Okay. So, the bottom line for that is that you tend to reduce your signal. If your network is changing quickly, you are reducing your signaling overhead. But you're introducing delay, and you have problems with cache consistency, and if things are changing rapidly, you still can't be assured of your route. Okay, so again, our final option is to look at flat versus hierarchical routing. And again, the benefit of hierarchical is that you can confine your routing to smaller network sizes and less nodes and smaller distances. So we have a number of examples. We'll just hop into those. So with zone-based, again, we're just physically dividing the network up. And again, within zones, we'll do proactive routing. So we'll maintain an accurate picture of what's happening over a small area. And then between zones, we can either do reactive or proactive. But again, depending how you divide things up, you should be able to keep things at sort of manageable levels. Okay, with cluster-based, we essentially have a cluster. We combine a number of nodes, and we appoint a cluster head, which acts as a gateway from one cluster into another. Okay. So again, we can route within our cluster, but then to go from cluster to cluster, we have to send through our gateway. And again, this is usually used in fairly dynamic topologies. And the main challenge is to be able to maintain our cluster structure. Okay, so if the things move too fast, then again, the clusters are changing rapidly. One example where this tends to be used is in vehicular traffic, because you assume that there is a bit of a topology imposed with cars because they have to stay on the road, so they're all tends to be one after the other. Okay, core-based. So here you can attempt to define a backbone network, so like our mesh, our wireless mesh network,
Then again, route through our core.
Okay, so if our core is stable, we can do our more traditional forms of routing and then just worry about connecting to it. Okay, so again, the use of hierarchical routing is to reduce the communication and computation overheads.
But we will have to make effort to maintain our
hierarchy in a situation where everything is mobile. Okay, so that's it. Again, just a sort of high-level overview of what the issues become if you have this sort of pathological type of network. That's pretty much it for the module. I will post just a quick review slide document. And so that just lists the examinable topics. So I don't examine NS3 or the introduction. And then it gives you what material is available. If you go to Moodle and find the loop and find that some of this isn't available, send me an email. It's probably, I just haven't unhidden the link or forgotten to post it. So this all should be available to you. Again, it's a couple of problem sets. All of the lecture notes and the Camtasia recordings. And again, you can pry out the registry, all the old exam papers, and they're worth looking at, I'd say. So there's a lot of, sort of essay type questions. Well, you'll see what the style is. There's essay type questions, knowledge type questions, and they can. There's lots that I can ask there, but then there's also a lot of problem work. So if you understand the problems, if you understand the problem sets and have done, and looked at the old exams, and probably if you're happy with that, you should be pretty well set on that end. So if you have any questions, if anything arises, just feel free to email me. I'll either set up an appointment or, deal with you online. So, good luck. See you again One side or the other of Christmas.
Thank you.